Hey everyone, it's Jason Kelly, Bloomberg Quick Takes chief correspondent. Well, I recently had the opportunity to head to Miami to spend a couple days with Alex Rodriguez. Yep, that one. A-Rod. Look, this is a guy who is a three-time most valuable player, 14-time All-Star, World Series champion with the Yankees, and when he retired in 2016, he was the highest paid player in MLB history. But his career is always going to be remembered for another record as well. He served the longest suspension in baseball history for PED use. And now, 5 years after his retirement, and as he's being considered for the Hall of Fame, Alex Rodriguez, the CEO, he's getting back into sports. He's the new owner of the Minnesota Timberwolves and the Minnesota Lynx. So we were filming this new series we're launching for Quick Take Originals called Athlete Empire. So I got a chance to ride in his car with A-Rod to Westminster Christian. That's his old high school there in Miami. During our visit there, I had some of the most interesting and revealing conversations with him about his childhood, his career, and how his suspension changed him, not just as a person, but as a businessman.
We're driving to Westminster High School. I went from that campus, prom, to Fenway.
Yeah.
And while I was 18 and I looked like a 25-year-old. I had the emotional awareness of a 10-year-old boy, right? And it takes time to catch up. I wanted always to go to college. And the gift and the curse was, the gift was, I had this great talent. I was the number one pick in the country. But how do you say no to the number one pick when my mother is working 18 hours a day? And I wanted to be a quarterback at the University of Miami. I wanted to play shortstop. And I had this great blessing of going number one and going right to Seattle.
Tell me about those early Miami days. I mean, especially, you know, we're almost literally driving down memory lane to your high school. It's like when you go back there, and I know you spend a lot of time there, like, what are those early memories like of being here? You moved here when? How old were you?
So I was born in New York,
right.
Raised in Miami. So when I got to Miami, I was around 8.5, 9 years old. And thank God for the Boys and Girls Club, because my father left when I was around 10 and left my mother and my two siblings behind, my brother and my sister, both older. And at that time, my mom then had to take on two jobs. I had to go to school. And at home, it was mom, my brother Joe, and my sister Susie. They took the role of, like, my brother became like the secretary of sports, my sister became the secretary of education, and my mom just had to, you know, make enough money to pay our bills. And that's kind of how we survived. And then I had the Boys and Girls Club, which was a great asset and protector in my life. But as we drive to Westminster, a lot of people don't know is I got there as a skinny, scrawny 15-year-old boy. I was 6'1", 150 pounds, and I was a reject from Columbus, Christopher Columbus, nearby high school. And I was told I was a very good basketball player, and they wanted me to play basketball at Columbus, and an okay baseball player. And my body hadn't caught up to my age. So when I got to Westminster, one of the reasons why I went there, I wanted an opportunity to play baseball. So when I got there, I was 15, and definitely not a finished product.
But you knew you were a pretty good baseball player.
I knew I was good, but not great. And partly because I was always playing with kids that were a little bit older. And, you know, there's a big difference between being 13 years old and 15, or 11 and 13. So I was always good enough to be middle of the road, but I was always the youngest kid. And I had an option to play with younger kids or older kids. And my family always made the decision, there's no reason to stay back. We're just going to keep pushing forward.
So fast forward me a little bit to that moment that you described it a couple minutes ago, where you got this decision to make. I mean, it's pure economics, right? Go pro.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and also opportunity.
Yeah.
I mean, usually you would say, if you're a middle to late first rounder, you can make a pretty sound argument that college is the best thing for you and you're going to develop there, and when you come out in 3 years, you're going to be educated, you're going to be stronger, more mature, and you have an opportunity to be you know, top five pick.
Yeah.
You couldn't make that argument if you're 1-1.
Right.
And it came down to the wire, to the 11th hour. But finally, in the wee hours of the night, we ended up signing the contract for about $1.3 million.
And is that a conversation? I mean, is that you and your mom, like, just having that conversation? Like, what's that like?
Yeah, that's me, my mom, my sister, my brother. I mean, that was the core. And my mother, to her credit, I mean, we didn't have anything. I don't think my mother had $500 in the bank, right? We lived, you know, paycheck to paycheck. And she, there were $1 million, we were $1.5 million that sat for the whole summer. There wasn't a lot of movement. And my mother said, if they don't give us our number, you're going to college. And I was like, holy smokes.
Wow.
You're the bravest woman I've ever met. Bravest person I've ever met. And sure enough, they came up and she said, okay, let's go. And I signed the contract.
Wow. So it was that close.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What were you feeling at that moment?
I was feeling a lot of pressure. I certainly felt that I had a responsibility to provide for my family, for sure. And again, it was a mixed bags of emotions. Yeah. I was so bummed that I couldn't attend the University of Miami. I was so much wanted to play quarterback there. Obviously, we had a very rich football tradition,
yeah.
Rich baseball tradition with Ron Frazier and Coach Kelly. And I wanted to go and play baseball. I was right here in the neighborhood in the Coral Gables. And, you know, growing up in Miami for a long time, we didn't have a professional sports team. So, you know, Ron Frazier and the University of Miami baseball was everything. And, of course, the football team had won four or five championships. And I just wanted to kind of jump into that rich tradition and wear orange and green.
Is it a shock to the system to, as you say, like, go from prom to Fenway? I mean...
Well, first, I stopped in Appleton, Wisconsin, 1994. I showed up, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, April, opening day, mid-A-ball, and it's like 20 degrees and snow on the ground. I'm like, what in the world? Why aren't I at the University of Miami?
Yeah, right.
And all my buddies were in colleges. They were all freshmen. They were all like having a great time, partying, drinking from kegs.
Going to frat parties.
Fraternity houses. Yeah. I'm like, okay, I got the wrong deal here. And then I played for a few months. And then got promoted to AA. And sometime in the summer, I got the call.
Wow.
To go to the big leagues. And I'm like, oh my God, all of this happened. Westminster Christian, drafted number one, Appleton, Wisconsin, big leagues, all within like a few months.
Yeah. What's that first moment like when you step onto a major league field?
Scary.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember facing Roger Clemens. And my knees were shaking. I'm like, oh my gosh. And there was 37,000 people there. I'm like, I'm used to playing in front of 370 people. And it was scary. It was fun. But I mean, I was still 3 years away from legally being able to drink.
Yeah.
So all my teammates afterwards would go to the bar. And I couldn't go.
Yeah. So, and what is that like as a young guy? Like, a young guy, I mean, obviously, your athletic talent speaks for itself, but, like, socially, that's tough. Like, that's a strange place to be.
I mean, it was so strange. And at the time, Goose Gossage was on the team. And I think Goose was, like, 43 or 44. He had, like, a bunch of kids. And I'm going, like, what am I doing here? How can I be playing with these men?
Yeah.
It was strange, it was fun, it was scary, all of it.
Even at that point though, like, you're asking for advice, like, you're seeking people out. Is that just, like, your natural way of being, or what was driving you to do that?
Yeah, I think, you know, my father leaving us at 10 kind of left a huge vacant spot, right? And I think I was drawn to strong, powerful men. And I needed to then kind of fill that void by having a collection of mentors. And so I was always drawn to strong men who had strong opinions. And I ended up, like you're interviewing me, I would end up interviewing a lot of my teammates and my mentors. And that's kind of how I started to learn the way and expedite my learning curve, because I was 18 in the major leagues. If I didn't expedite it, I was gonna be cooked.
Yeah. How did you decide who you wanted to talk to?
I'm an audio learner and a visual learner. So there's a reason why Scottie Pippen, after a while, started looking like Michael Jordan. There's a reason why, after a while, Kobe looked like Michael Jordan too. I ended up resembling some of the Cal Ripken, yeah, because I studied them for so long, just like Scottie and Kobe studied Michael. So you study, you watch, you prepare. And because I was always kind of middle of the road as a young kid, I felt like I needed to always be extremely well prepared and ready to go, or else I was just gonna fall off.
Have you always felt a lot of pressure?
I mean, yes and no, in a weird way. The least amount of pressure I felt has been post my suspension. Because in a way, it's like, it was a little bit of a reset.
Yeah.
I hit rock bottom. It was humiliating. And I never felt like I would get a second chance to come back. And I remember while serving my suspension and spending time at home with the girls, I said, boy, if I ever get another one more chance, I'm gonna make the best of it.
Yeah.
And I think just that hitting rock bottom for me allowed me to turn the lens inward and almost kind of rewiring of the brain a little bit, where you come at it with a different perspective, a different gratitude. And look, I think when you go from Westminster to Fenway, while that trajectory is exciting and fun, I think it creates some enormous blind spots.
Yeah.
And boy, I had some blind spots that were just getting bigger and bigger. And the first time that I was basically told no from this campus at 15 to the suspension at 38 or 39, that's a long time with yeses.
Yeah.
So it allowed me to reset everything and kind of set me up. As painful as that was, those lessons learned allowed me to set up for the second half, the back nine of my life.
Did you ever worry you wouldn't get a second chance?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot. There was many times that I thought about, I've never thought in my life about quitting anything. And there were many nights there that I thought about tapping out.
Yeah.
And just going to an island and go, okay, I've screwed things up enough here. It's time for me to go home and quit.
And when did you feel like you were being given a second chance? Was there a moment, or did it just sort of happen gradually that you just, like, one foot in front of the other, just doing it?
I just knew that I was, like I was out of chances, so there's no more that you can say. It was time to kind of walk the walk. In my darkest hour, I got some great advice to reach out to about a dozen people that have been really, really important in my life. They were brief. I mean, there were, some of them were a minute and a half. And it was just me basically saying, hey, Jason, I just wanted you to hear from me. As you know, I'm serving this long suspension. I just want to say I'm sorry. I screwed up. And I just want you to know that I'm serving my time and I'm trying to be as productive as possible and doing some work on myself. And I just wanted you to hear it from me. And boom. And to this day, all of those people are still my partners. And to this day, they go back to that phone call as one of the most important things that I've done. And I thought that was, for me, an interesting lesson that in the darkest hour, you just show up and you're accountable.
How does that influence your business decisions? Like that knowledge? Because you've got to carry that with you, right? Like that knowledge and both the expectation of yourself as well as people you're in business with.
You never want to make those phone calls again.
Yeah.
If you play it straight, there's going to be strikeouts along the way. You're not going to go 5 for 5 every game. That goes for business. But as long as you're doing things with transparency and integrity and you're giving it your best shot every day and you have complete alignment, you know, things are going to happen.
Yeah.
And I think when you have partners, you know, be available, answer the phone, and be accountable. I think people will always appreciate that.
So once we got to Westminster, we linked up with some of the A-Rod Corp team. We got a tour of the baseball field and a new auditorium that Rodriguez and one of his companies renovated into a state-of-the-art performance center. Rodriguez, not surprisingly, is recognized by teachers, administrators, parents, and students. My favorite student that we ran into was D'Angelo Ortiz. This is Big Poppy's son, David Ortiz. David Ortiz, the same guy who was once one of A-Rod's biggest rivals, and now they're broadcast partners. And another current Westminster parent, her name is Erin Knight. She met Rodriguez when she was a freshman, and he, A-Rod, was a recently transferred sophomore, so they were both new to the school. She's now the president of Monument Capital Management. That's the real estate division of A-Rod Corp. So we sat down in the courtyard to chat for a bit.
We were the new kids. This is a K through 12 school, so we were both coming at odd entry points, 9th and 10th. His more odd than mine.
And we met right there, about 25 feet from here. And yeah, we kind of hit it off and the rest is history.
And so, yeah, so talk about that history because you're in high school together, but then obviously your paths diverge. You go to Florida State,
yes.
Is that right? You go to the Seattle Mariners.
Yeah.
How do you keep in touch over that time?
I scratch my head at that one sometimes because this was before cell phones. So I think we landline letters, but we managed to do it.
They pursued different careers. Rodriguez went to the major leagues. He went from the Mariners to the Rangers and ultimately to the Yankees. Knight pursued her own successful career in commercial banking back in Miami.
I remember had to be after I was graduated from college, we were at the same gym and we sat around, we're chatting and he said, hey, remember your old neighborhood where I used to drive you home sometimes? I'm buying duplexes over there. And I said, really? Because the area was up and coming. And he said, yeah. Going in duplex, fourplex, eightplex. I want to start building multifamily investments. I'm not going to play forever. And this will be a great income stream.
Through that time, Knight continued to be a sounding board for Rodriguez in business and in personal matters, and especially as his choices led to one of his darkest times.
Over time, you develop these blind spots. And over the course of leaving this campus as Alex Rodriguez being the number one pick, largest contract in Major League Baseball history, turn into A-Rod, and then slowly but surely coming back to the person that I was here on this campus and getting back to Alex Rodriguez and kind of my core values. A pivotal time in my life was 2014, while I served the longest suspension in Major League Baseball history. Erin and I spent hundreds of hours, like really kind of breaking down. At the same time, I was doing my therapy. At the same time, I was spending a great deal of time with my daughters. And it was really the low point in my life. But along the way, we had a gazillion conversations about, okay, this is what I'm seeing. This is how I see it. Now tell me what you're seeing. And a lot of times it was like night and day.
Right.
And as I got, you know, less regressed and I kept working on my therapy, we started seeing things a lot more clear.
When 2014 came, I remember him digging deep and thinking, and it was really a pause that was needed. He was on such a fast track, and it was a forced pause, and sometimes those are the best pauses in our life because it allows you to open up and see things differently. So he did that, and he could have continued to be defensive, but he said, let me open up and turn the lens inward.
While I was serving my suspension, we would have dinners and we would have a glass of wine, and we would pull out a Wall Street Journal or New York Times, an article, and we would both read it. And I would say, see, there's nothing wrong with this. And she would say, are you sick? Are you on drugs? There's everything wrong with this article.
Right.
And I'm like, okay, but where? It actually is not that bad. Look at it. And I was like, she was like, first of all, if you want to be the business person you want to be, if you want to be a fiduciary to other people's capital, this crap cannot happen. And parallel to that, I'm doing my therapy. Parallel to that, I'm kind of attacking my blind spots. But she gave me so many raw truths that is really invaluable.
So what were those stories about that you were reading that...
Yeah, it might have been about the biogenesis. It might have been about my suspension. It might have been about, you know, my crazy appearance on a talk show, mm-hmm. a radio show. And I wasn't seeing it straight.
Yeah.
And I was kind of... I don't think I was even lying to myself. I just had a blind spot.
Yeah.
And she would literally take out a highlight and go, awful, worse, terrible. You want me to keep going?
Yeah.
I'm like... No, you can stop now. I got it.
The glass was half full, right? Yeah. And there would be any glimmer of something that he could, I think, blame someone else. That it was someone else's fault. And he would focus on that in the article. And I'd say, no, this is not good.
Her willingness to tell him the truth was valuable in his private life. But Rodriguez also saw her as someone who could be a partner in his commercial aspirations. Now she oversees what's essentially the foundation of A-Rod Corp, the real estate business that started with that first Miami duplex. Monument, it's acquired more than 60 deals worth more than $900 million since 2012.
You know, I was always in such a place of admiration for Erin, and I always dreamt about having her one day join our firm, and forever I failed. But I felt I was getting closer. And then I had her almost act like as an advisor board member to A-Rod Corp, where she started interviewing a lot of our great, you know, hires. And I think she saw from afar that the elevation of talent we were getting was getting better and better. And eventually she said yes.
When I joined about 3 years ago, we were launching our fourth fund. And the growth of Monument had been slow and steady. Very much a pattern of let's create a good track record, and it was friends and family to Alex and Ray Corona, our other general partner. And so 2019, launching a fourth fund and really professionalizing and growing. So we've done that, deployed it successfully, managed through COVID, and we're going to continue fifth fund and 9 states we operate in. We manage about 6,000 units. And over all that time since he started Monument, have bought close to $1 billion in multifamily assets.
And now, with the empire continuing to grow, Rodriguez and Knight, they're both conscious of the pitfalls.
He does have this vision, and that's what you want in your leader, to push the company, to push the teammates to be more and do more. And so there's a balance from, you know, he has great vision to, this might be a blind spot in the vision.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, those conversations are so priceless. And Erin is across the entire company, holding company. She's sits in committees. She's an advisor across.
Right.
In the Timberwolves, I'm asking her advice, right?
Yeah.
Because we always go back to those conversations and say, am I not seeing something here?
Thanks so much for listening. For more on how Rodriguez, along with Knight and the rest of the team, are building one of the biggest businesses tied to an athlete, check out our documentary, Athlete Empire, Alex Rodriguez. It's available at Bloomberg.com, Bloomberg Quick Take, and YouTube.